How the Vikings were won to Christ is an inspiring, incredible story. The Scandinavians were actually the very last people to be won to Christ of all of these great groups. And Elkane wrote of the shocking Viking raid on the monastery at Lindisfarne in AD 793. Never before has such a terror appeared in Britain as we have now suffered from a pagan race. Nor was it thought possible that such an inroad from the sea could be made. Behold, the church of St. Cuthbert, splattered with blood of the priests of God, despoiled of all its ornaments, a place more venerable than all in Britain, has fallen prey to pagans. That's an English historian in the court of Charlemagne wrote of the event. The Scandinavians were the very last group of the Teutonic people to abandon heathenism and to embrace Christianity. The Viking marauders from the pagan north wreaked absolute havoc throughout northern and western Europe. And throughout the 9th and the 10th centuries, the Vikings raided, they killed, and they plundered. And they were an inspiration for a new prayer which was added to the church liturgy. From the fury of the Northmen, O Lord, protect us. That was actually in the church liturgy every Sunday, because the Northmen were such a terror. And they looted and pillaged and destroyed and enslaved. And they were the most fearsome group that the people of Europe had ever faced. But nobody could have predicted at that time that the violent Vikings would be conquered by the Prince of Peace, and that they'd become some of the most enthusiastic missionaries for the advance of Christianity. The Viking era is normally dated from the raid on Lindisfarne. This is the ruins of Lindisfarne, which was 793 AD, and then all the way through to the Battle of Hastings in 1066, when the Vikings took England under the Norman invasion. So that's the bracket for the Viking era, Lindisfarne to Hastings. And that's Lindisfarne Island, Holy Island, and this dates back. It's a great venerable mission station from which the people of England were evangelized. And the Celtic cross just shows the missionaries from Ireland who came and planted this wonderful mission base that became the victim of the Vikings. This is Oxford being burned by the Danes back in the 10th century under huge pillaging and attacks from a Danish invasion. But although we know of the Vikings as raiders, they also were settlers. They established strong Viking settlements in Normandy, England, Scotland, Iceland, Ireland, Greenland, throughout the Baltic, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and in Russia. And you can actually see here how far afield they went. They went all the way through Russia, through to the Black Sea, into the Mediterranean. Their longboats could literally manage with just 3 meter depth of water. Absolutely extraordinary what they could do with their longboats. They could go right up rivers. They not only were able to discover the Faroe Islands and settle them, and Iceland, but Greenland, and even North America. They went all the way to what they called Vinland, or what today is Newfoundland. Erik the Red and Leif Erikson, 500 years before the days of Columbus, they were on the shores of North America fighting against the North American Indians. Ansgar is often known as the great apostle to the north. He was one of the great missionaries who won the Scandinavians to Christ and laid foundations. When the Vikings were the terror of Europe, God placed a great missionary burden on young Ansgar. And with his own money, Ansgar redeemed several Danish youths who were slaves, and he attacked them to be his co-workers and bring the gospel to their countrymen. And Denmark is the oldest of the Scandinavian nations to be united and to develop its own flag and to be a kingdom united, and they were the ones who actually led the way both in attacking Europe and in colonizing Norway and Sweden. At one stage, all of those countries were under Denmark. Harald, the king of Denmark, had been driven from his throne and sought refuge at the court of Louis I, Louis the Pious, king of the Franks. And while at Louis's court, King Harald heard the gospel, he turned to Christ, he submitted himself to being baptized. And on the king's return to Denmark, Ansgar eagerly joined the king to preach the gospel to the Danes. And at Hedby, Ansgar built a small wooden church, but persecution forced him to flee the country years later. Sweden was the next to hear the gospel in the Viking world. Ansgar responded to a request from King Bjorn of Sweden. So while he was exiled from Denmark, he had the opportunity now to go and plant the gospel in Sweden. And this was early in the 9th century, the 800s, when the Vikings were raiding, plundering, burning the coastal cities of northern Western Europe. Ansgar narrowly escaped with his life when the Norsemen burned the churches and monastery in Hamburg. With two co-workers, Ansgar crossed the Baltic Sea. He began ministering in Sweden, and this is a monument to Ansgar in Sweden. On the way, the vessel was plundered by pirates, and they arrived destitute in Sweden. King Bjorn welcomed the Christians to Sweden, and the first church was built in the country.
Peter, sorry to ask again, of what nationality was Ansgar?
Ansgar was Saxon. Oh. He was a Saxon, but he had been brought up in the kingdom of the Franks in northern of what would be today France, but he was Saxon. So Ansgar is the greatest name in the church in the whole of Scandinavia. They call him the apostle to the north.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he's well known also in northern Germany.
Like Boniface. He is to Scandinavia what Boniface mm-hmm. would be to mm-hmm. Germany. Yes. And although the Vikings are famous for their hit-and-run raids, the Vikings actually had other impacts, and the fact that we have a 7-day week is testimony to the fact that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. But the names of our week was first given by the Romans, and the Romans named the weeks after the celestial planets: the Sun, the Moon, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, and Saturn. So we've now only got Sunday, Monday, and the seventh being Saturn Day. But the Vikings renamed four of those. And so Tuesday is now named after, instead of being Mars Day, it's now Tyr Day or Tyr Day, the name of the Viking god of war, Tyr. And Wednesday, named after the greatest of all the Viking gods, Woden or Odin. He had the raven and he had this 8-legged horse, and he would charge out leading all the Viking warriors who'd ever died in battle courageously, and that would be Odin. He is the king of all the Viking gods of war. So Woden's Day or Wednesday. Thor's Day is named after Thor, the god of war. Another one, they had a lot of gods of war, but Thor was the son of Odin. Odin is the top god, but Thor was the most popular in many ways. And then Friday is named after the Viking fertility goddess Frigg or Frey. So four of our days of the week in the English calendar have the names of Viking gods, and the other three have Roman celestial planets being named. So while the Vikings were raiders, they did impact a culture. And also there's a whole lot of English words that have got their root in Scandinavian speech. For example, the word anger is a Scandinavian word, a Viking word. Die is another Viking word. Scant, ugly, loose, wrong. These are Viking words. Low, sky, take, not surprising, take, something they did. Window, husband, happy, thrive, ill, even beer and anchor. Anchor is a good naval word. All of that comes from the Viking words. Even the word berserk, that was the name of a Viking warrior. A berserker was a Viking warrior. So to say he's going berserk is to say he's acting like a Viking soldier. Well, Thor was the great god of war, and he was the most feared of the gods and the most popular of all the gods of the Vikings. And you can see they were very much into the pagan ideas of the ancestral spirits and the powers of the demon gods over them. At an assembly of the people in Denmark, a question was debated as to whether the missionaries should be allowed to continue to preach Christ and so invite the anger of the old Viking gods. And at a critical point in the discussions, an old Viking stood up and he declared with great force that it was clear that the Christian God is greater than Thor. So this decided the matter, and the missionaries received freedom to continue to preach the gospel in Sweden. Now, why was it, if the Christian God was so much greater than Thor, that the Christians were being beaten up by the Vikings? Well, this was easily understood as they were God's judgment upon a weak, backslidden, and apostate church. More than any previous invasions and crises faced by the Christian church, The Viking raids brought desolation throughout the Western Christendom. And the Vikings laid waste to monasteries and churches, and they shook the churches to their foundations. A decline and a decay in faith and morals had set in long before the Viking invasions, and many saw the fury of the Norsemen as a judgment of God upon a backslidden, often apostate church. But there was a line drawn, and that was in Wessex. The resistance began in Wessex under King Alfred the Great. Churches and monasteries were being destroyed, clergy and monks were slain, church buildings lay vacant, until in the south of England the West Saxons were rallied by King Alfred the Great, the only king of England to ever be called great, and the true first king of England, in a sense, he is the first king of England to really unite the whole nation, to steadfastly resist and to ultimately defeat the great Danish invasion. You can see how the English were invaded at different times. At one time it was the Saxons coming in and pushed the Celts into Wales and Scotland and Ireland. And then there were the Frisians and the Angles. The Angles, from where you get the name Angleland. And the Jutes, also from Jutland. And now they're going to be coming from Scotland. So King Alfred himself is the descendant of the Saxons who had taken the land earlier on, a few centuries before the Vikings came. Now when the Vikings came, the Saxons rediscovered their fury and their fighting spirit, and they were able to be an every bit the equal of the Vikings. Now here you can see this horse, the white horse at Ashdown. The Battle of Ashdown is one of the most important battle sites in English history, and that's where Alfred made his stand and he defeated the Danes, and from that point the Danish King Guthrum was converted, baptized and submitted to Christian discipleship, and Alfred the Great spent 12 days teaching him the basics of the gospel, and 30 of his nobles had to be baptized with him. And this is the statue at Wantage. Lynn and I managed to visit Wantage, which is the birthplace of King Alfred in England, and this is the founder of the common law of England. You can see he's got this massive battle axe. He's got the dooms, the first law, which was the foundation of the English law, the common law. It's called the common law because it's common to all, high and low, all people the same. And the act showed he is serious. And this is what it says: King Alfred the Great, the West Saxon king, born at Wantage, AD 849. Alfred found learning dead, and he restored it. Education neglected, and he revived it. The laws powerless, and he gave them force. The church debased, and he raised it. The land ravaged by a fearful enemy, from which he delivered it. Alfred's name shall live as long as mankind shall respect the past. And this great monument at Wantage, which is just south of Oxford. Just south of Oxford, Wantage.
Oxford.
Mm. And beautiful little village marketplace, which has been a centre of market activity for something in the region of 1200 years. So the conversion of the Vikings actually begins with the West Saxons and King Alfred. In 878, after King Guthrum had defeated the Danish army at Ashdown, here you can actually see we've got Oxford, and down here Wantage, and there's the Battle of Ashdown, just south of Oxford. Reading, we would read it Reading, but the British say Reading. Winchester was...
Where was the white horse?
Right here, next to Wantage. Ashdown battle site, just outside of his birthplace. And Winchester, further south, close to the coast, that was his headquarters. And of course, we had no place like Salisbury, and where he went, Devonshire and Somersetshire and Dorchester, some of the place where they were beaten back into and became a guerrilla fighter. King Alfred fought a stunning amount of battles against the Danes. But after the Battle of Ashdown, 878, King Guthrum and 30 of his leaders were required to be baptized as Christians. Now this is extraordinary because he could have massacred them. He could have sold them as hostages and gotten a fortune. But he chose to have them baptized and discipled as Christians. In 882, another Viking leader in the lower Rhine region abandoned heathenism and embraced Christianity, receiving baptism in the name of the Lord Jesus. And this is a baptismal font where the man received his baptism. You can see it's extraordinary symbols. This is still in a church up in the lower Rhine region. Duke Rollo of the Vikings and some of his followers received baptism, created the Duchy of Normandy, and they were the very Normans who invaded England in 1066. The Vikings were impressed by Christ. The ethics of Christianity were so radically different to traditional Viking culture that it took literally centuries for the Scandinavian people to be thoroughly evangelized and discipled. And it does take centuries, actually, for a culture to be thoroughly permeated with the gospel to the extent that it can be rid of the heathen residue and be consistently Christian. So one of the chief attractions was the conviction that Christ is a mighty victor. He has risen triumphant over death. The power of Christ impressed the hardened Viking warriors. In Norway, the king commanded his people to be converted to Christ or be prepared to die. But in Denmark and Sweden, the Vikings were converted by persuasion, not force. Pioneer missionaries Willebrod and Ludger attempted to take the gospel to the Vikings, but initially with very little visible success. Ansgar was the very successful missionary to the Vikings, the pioneer who kicked down the door and made the rest of the work possible. So Tremaine for Ansgar, born of Saxon parents in northwest of France in 801, which is right in the time of Charlemagne, Charles the Great, and the beginning of the Holy Roman Empire. It was Ansgar who succeeded where others had failed. Ansgar was described as a sensitive child who had led a devout life. He experienced visions, dreams. He possessed a combination of humility, of self-forgetfulness, unselfishness, and of undaunted courage and energetic initiative, to quote from a contemporary. And he managed to win Sweden to Christ. King Harald of Denmark was baptized in 826 in Mainz. And this is something you see throughout the Christianization of Europe. The kings and chiefs were converted first, and this led to the rest. And this is the way it's been through the centuries, and there's nothing wrong with that model. Many in Africa and also in the South Sea Islands in the Pacific, the kings were converted, the chiefs were converted, and then the people were able to be evangelized. And so many people have a resistance to this, to such an extent that at the end of the Second World War, when Americans had defeated Japan, a fine evangelical Christian, General Douglas MacArthur, goes in to Tokyo, and the emperor comes to him and says, "I suppose I must be baptized as a Christian." And the general, to his shame, because he's a man I normally respect, but on this occasion I think he evidenced the baptistic individualism, which is often a danger. And he said, "Oh no, that's a very personal decision." Now, after so many people had died, it would have been so good to have made some good meaning out of this horrific war in the Pacific, to have said, yes, that's exactly what you should do. Because if the emperor of Japan had been converted, all of Japan would have had to be formally converted. Now, we're not suggesting that makes a person born again, but that's what opens them up to evangelism and discipleship and makes them open and responsive to the preaching of the word. So this resistance to evangelism by going through the kings and the chiefs first is really faulty, because it worked exceptionally well all the way through the 19th century. But the 20th century, with its individualism, has lost nations. Instead of winning nations to Christ, we've lost nations, because we're not trying to convert the leaders. And when you defeat a leader, what's wrong with telling the leader, you must submit to Christ? Why not? Because after all, the Shinto religion was worship of the emperor. If they were worshipping the emperor, and the emperor now says, "I worship Christ," you would de facto have the whole of Japan would have been once Christ. Today, the number of Christians in Japan, Catholic and Protestants, is less than 3%. It's very low. And it could be so different. Japan is one of the hardest mission fields in the world, and it honestly could be different. And I don't want to blame General MacArthur in one sense, even though he was the man responsible, but he was reflecting a mindset of the whole of the American people at that stage that I think was deadly. They had lost the concept of being a Christian nation, and they'd lost the concept of what they were actually fighting for. It's just like when the British, under General Allenby, finally captured Jerusalem in 1817 from the 1917 from the Turks. They didn't know what to do with it. This is exactly what their forefathers, Richard the Lionheart and others, have been struggling how many generations to get Jerusalem. They get Jerusalem, then they sort of hand it over after they just liberated it. What was the point? After all of that effort, they didn't know what to do with their gains.
But the humanists The humanists go for the leaders.
They know what to do.
They know what to do.
Yes, that's right.
And they've sort of undone us to such an extent that we don't know any, yes.
So this is the problem in our battle for Christian civilization now, is Christians have lost the vision of winning nations to Christ. But King Harald of Denmark was baptized in Mainz, 826, and some of the first pagans in Sweden requested baptism, including the leader of Birka. That's an island lake, Malar, you see up here Birka, not far from the present capital of Stockholm. Stockholm didn't exist at that stage, so it's not on the map yet. This is the way it was. And by the way, notice the term the Vik. The Vik is this narrow inlet or ford here between the head of the line and the paws of the line of Scandinavia. That's where the word Viking comes from, the original Vik or inlet or fjords. And so the original Vikings actually grew up around the Vik. And that's where, in fact, Norway was proclaimed to be Christian as well. It's a very historic area. But that's the beginning. This is the core of where the Vikings started and where they started to be converted as well. But despite serious reverses and violence and destruction of churches, Ansgar did not give up. He persevered, and soon Danish missionaries were being sent to establish churches in Sweden. And Ansgar's faithful work was continued by his disciple Rimbert, who ministered both amongst the Danes and the Swedes. Rimbert was succeeded by Adelgar, all of these great Saxon missionaries. There was a lot of opposition and persecution, which is symbolized here by some actual Viking weaponry that's been dug up and archaeological digs. And you can see, obviously, the wooden handles have rotted away. You've just got the metal parts, the wooden sheath of the haft of the axe or the spear has rotted away, but you can see the metal parts of it. Very advanced weaponry for the time. Early in the 10th century, King Gorm of Denmark, a determined enemy of Christianity, determined to banish Christianity from his realm. Many ministers and missionaries are martyred. Numerous churches were burned to the ground. And Ansgar ministered over 40 years in Scandinavia. And here we can see Ansgar being depicted later in life in his ongoing work there. But the Saxons were championing the Christian cause at this time. Here you can see some of the Saxon war shields. This is actually from the British Museum, and a Saxon war helmet. You can see how the full face protection, ear protection of a Saxon war helmet, and a Saxon shield. These are actual originals. I mean, these go back 1300 years. And this church is the oldest Saxon church in England. It dates all the way back to the 6th century. The rocks are even built from rocks from Hadrian's Wall, which is not far. And so they brought some of the stones from there and they built this magnificent church. As the Saxons grew in strength, they became champions of the Christian cause. And when Henry became king of the Germans in 919, Henry sponsored numerous missionary outreaches to the Danes. And after his victory over the Danes in 934, King Henry compelled their rulers to accept Christianity. So here you can see, this is quite standard. You defeat the people and you force them to abandon their heathen ways and to embrace your faith. Unni was encouraged by the king to renew the work of Ansgar, and Gorm's successor, King Harald, looked with favour upon Unni's attempts to reassemble the scattered remnants of the Christian communities on the Danish Isles and to bring in ministers to rebuild these congregations. So Unni was one of the ministers, Gorm was the enemy of the gospel, but his son, King Harald, was a convert. This is a Danish military camp inside England. This is exactly how they built it up. Full fortifications with drainage ditches, always circular. They had them in quadrants, four sections, so you'd have these four separate regiments. And this would be a military type establishment from which they would do their raids when they were based in England. But it's in these places that the gospel started to really take root. King Henry's son Otto the Great became king of the Holy Roman Empire in 936, and in 962 he was crowned emperor of the whole Holy Roman Empire. And under royal favour, the churches experienced a wave of reform with a tremendous revival of devotion and enthusiasm. King Harald of Denmark extended his realm and he became overlord of Norway. He himself was baptised, and so he encouraged the spread of Christianity throughout his realms, including Norway. And this whole time is a time of the church growing amongst the Vikings, despite tremendous opposition. Harald's son Sven attempted to bring about a pagan rebellion against his father, and he actually saw his father die in the struggle in 986, and Sven severely persecuted the Christians and repeatedly invaded England, where he died in 1014. In Sweden, a pagan king, Eric, arose hostile to Christianity, yet the church continued to grow. And the missionary Poppo won many thousands to the Christian faith in Denmark. And Odenkarl was a missionary from Denmark who strengthened the gospel work in Sweden. And then King Canute. We've all heard of King Canute. And he was not only king of England, he was king of Denmark and, for a time, Norway too. And he sponsored missions in England and Denmark. Under King Canute, the church was firmly established in Denmark, and Canute later became king over all England. And under his support, missionaries from Germany established more churches in Denmark. He commanded his subjects to learn the Lord's Prayer, to be faithful in communion with the Lord. And the church in Denmark deepened and grew with strong ties to the Saxon church in Germany and England. So, of course, there's this great linguistic, cultural, racial link. They're all basically interrelated tribes between the Scandinavians, the Saxons, and so the Danes, the Norwegians, the Germans were at one time very kindred, and that's where the missionary work was flourishing. And this is where the missions to Norway began, the most violent of all the Vikings. The conversion of the Vikings in Norway was far more stormy than that of Denmark. Throughout the 10th century, Saxon missionaries from England labored throughout Denmark and established many mission stations and congregations. And from the time of King Alfred the Great, the revived church in England evidenced the dynamic vitality in missions to the Vikings. And the Kingdom of Norway was established under Olaf Haraldsson. The Norwegian kingdom was actually the creation of Harald Haarfager, or Harald Fairhair, who died in 933. By a lot of combat, he had established himself as the overruler of all Norway. Now, he had two sons, Erik Bloodaxe, you can imagine how he got that name, and Hakon the Good. And believe it or not, Hakon the Good is the one who was converted and was good, and Erik Bloodaxe was the one who is the enemy of the gospel, so the names kind of give this away quite well. And they struggled over the succession. Hakon had been sent to England to study, and there he'd been converted, he'd been baptized, he'd been discipled as a Christian. And so by 935, the tall, young, handsome, athletic Hakon had established his supremacy through combat, which is the way you got elected head of anything. You beat everyone else in combat. And he was accepted as king of all Norway. And now there was a great royal mission to win the Vikings. Hakon attempted to win all his people to the Christian faith, and most of his immediate court were soon baptized. Later, he sent to England for missionaries, and he began to build churches in Norway. After he'd been reigning 15 years, by the year 950, Hakon proposed to the assembly of landowners that they adopt Christianity. And this picture sort of gives you the whole feel of the response of the people. It was violent, outrage, fury, anger. They were for the old pagan gods. They were not wanting to accept the Christianity of the king. And most of the landowners responded with great hostility, and they vehemently refused to abandon the old pagan ways. They began to place great pressure on the king to compromise and to participate in the pagan sacrifices. And facing open rebellion, King Hakon very reluctantly ate some of the meat in the ceremonial feast organized by his landowners. In fact, he made a sign of the cross over the food, and they asked what he was doing, and he said, it's Thor's hammer. So he compromised. And later, when he was wounded in battle on his deathbed in 961, Hakon declared his great remorse over that compromise and his desire to do penance for his sins. He realized he had compromised, and he should have stood for Christ at that point, but he was facing rebellion, but all it did was put off the evil day. And this is the feast where they are showing how they were trying to force him to make these this offering. They made the offering in the end, but they got him to eat some of it, in which way it was perceived that he had acceded to be part of this festival dedicated to Woden or Thor. It was a rocky road to converting the Vikings, and there were reverses. His nephew, Harald Graffel, succeeded to the throne of Norway, and while not as enthusiastic a Christian as Hakon, Harald Graffel did pull down pagan temples wherever he went. However, because of his misrule and because there's a lot of bad seasons, and this was blamed on the destruction of the pagan temples to Thor and Odin, and therefore the people resented the faith which he had violently championed. So in 970, Harald Greffel was lured to Denmark and killed, and King Harald Bluetooth of Denmark then made himself overlord of Norway and encouraged the spread of Christianity there, because Harald Bluetooth had been won over to the faith by the Saxons of Germany. But now we get to King Olaf, who's the most colourful of all the characters. When you talk about the winning of the Vikings, this is where you get the most interesting stories of all. Olaf Tryggvason was the son of the King of Norway. His great-grandfather was Harald Haarfagre, Fairhair, who had initially established the Kingdom of Norway by hard combat. So when Olaf's father was murdered in 968, Olaf fled the country with his mother, and the Vikings captured their ship and sold the boy into slavery, and Olaf ended up in the court of Russia's Tsar Vladimir. So he ended up with the Vikings, the Swedish Vikings, who were running Russia at that stage. These are the Rus. You can tell a very different type of armament and style and clothing. But these were the Swedish Vikings who raided east, while the Norwegians were raiding west and south. And under Russia's Tsar Vladimir I, Olaf ended up as a favorite of the queen. And when he was just 12 years old, the Tsar put a dozen ships under his command and sent him off into battle. And he was considered a Viking without equal. This Olaf Tryggvason was known as the ultimate Viking. He was tall, he was strong, he was handsome, he was unequaled in martial skill, and he led a huge army of Swedish Vikings, absolutely massive army, in 90 ships, and they went to devastate the Dutch. And after looting Holland, he went on to fight the French, and he left an enormous amount of death and destruction wherever he went. And as I said, he left much offerings of flesh to the ravens, because the ravens are considered to be Odin's or Woden's birds. You always have the raven represented by Woden. And so leaving corpses littering the landscape was considered sacrifices to Odin's raven. Well, his next target was England. And after the Battle of Maldon near the mouth of the Thames, he forced the Anglo-Saxon king Ethelred the Unready. And he's called the Unready because he wasn't ready for the battles ever. And Ethelred the Unready never had an army ready, so he had to pay a tribute of 10,000 pounds of silver to keep Olaf at bay. And after this, he went north, he plundered Northumberland and Scotland, and he attacked the Hebrides and the Isle of Man, and he conducted raids in Northern Ireland and Wales and Cornwall and France again. And then with 94 ships, he attacked England again, killed and looted wildly, until Ethelred offered him another 22,000 pounds of silver. But off the coast of Cornwall, Olaf heard of a local fortune teller who was renowned to have a gift of prophecy. So Olaf rode to this remote rocky island, this retreat, and he asked the prophet if he could foresee anything in his future. Well, this was the word of prophecy he received. You will become a renowned king, and you will do celebrated deeds. And that you should not doubt the truth of this answer. Listen to this. And then the old man prophesied that Olaf would soon suffer a mutiny from his own men, which is unthinkable. He had never been challenged before. During this, he'd be wounded. He'd be carried to ship on his oblong shield. And after 7 days, he'd recover, and he'd be baptized as a Christian. Many men will you bring to faith and baptism, and both to your own and to others' good. That was the prophecy. So when the mutiny occurred, and the wounding, and his recovery, exactly as had been predicted, Olaf sought the old man again and said, how can you possess such knowledge? And the man said, the God of the Christians has blessed me. And so Olaf was baptized. And when King Ethelred heard of the conversion and baptism of his tormentor, he sent his bishop and his officials to present great gifts to King Olaf and offer Christian fellowship. Well, in 995, news came from Norway that the leader, Earl Haakon, the very man who had murdered Olaf's father and exiled his mother and himself, the cause of all of his grief, actually, was now causing an uproar in the land by demanding the daughters of respected leaders of the community. And although Earl Haakon had originally accepted Christianity under threats from the German Emperor Otto, he had since reverted to heathenism. He is an apostate. And he had restored pagan temples. He was persecuting Christians. Earl Haakon the Apostate had even gone so far as to offer his best horses and his 17-year-old son to be killed as an offering to a heathen goddess. So he was as vile, as evil, as treacherous, a villain as you could ever want. And that was Earl Haakon. It's at this opportune time that Olaf, the great-grandson of Harald Fairhair, the one who had founded the Norwegian kingdom, determined to leave England, avenge the death of his mother, the exile of his mother, the slavery of his youth, and to end the pagan misrule and apostasy of Haakon. With just 5 ships, he landed in Norway and he claimed it for Christ. And soon, word reached him that Earl Haakon had angered 2 landowners, attempting to seize their wives for themselves, and the resistance was growing greatly. But when they heard that none other than the Viking without parallel, Olaf himself, that he was coming to challenge him, then the resistance to Haakon just spread throughout all of Norway. And Olaf was renowned as the Viking warrior of the greatest of height, of strength, of athletic stature, of superior skills in all the martial arts. And so he headed off, and he was renowned as the most bold and ruthless of all Vikings. And Earl Haakon fled and hid in a pit beneath a pigsty, where he was killed by his slave. And at National Assembly, Olaf was proclaimed king over all Norway. And then he travelled throughout the land, consolidating his rule and attempting to Christianize his people. Many of his relatives became his first converts, and he appointed them as Christ's captains. He said, "I will make you great and mighty men for doing this work. All Norway must be Christian or die." And the scattered settlements on the west and east shores of Oslo Fjord readily accepted baptism, but the people in the northern parts of the Vik resisted the gospel. So King Olaf challenged the followers of Thor and Odin to open combat, and by the end of the year he had convinced everyone that Christ is greater than Thor and greater than Odin. As King Olaf moved to the western northern fjords of Norway, he challenged the heathen to swimming races and to archery contests and mortal combat. And his message was always to the point, repent or die. Those who chose to fight were always quickly defeated by Olaf's superior strength and skill. And he dealt with opposition in a very clear way. King Olaf declared all the heathen gods were demons. The power behind all idols were evil, spirits. All sorcerers and those who promoted idolatry and heathenism were to be banished. Wizards and priests who resisted were to be killed. He took some incorrigibles who wouldn't abandon Thor, and he took them out to a remote island just off the shore during low tide and marooned them there. Which meant when high tide came in, they'd be drowned. He said, "You don't want to be baptized, I give you to the sea." And at Trondheim, which had been the stronghold of the late heathen King Earl Haakon, Olaf burned the heathen temples, destroyed the idols, and the local chiefs rose up in rebellion against him. And he gave a clear choice, baptism or battle. And he came in with 30 ships, anchored in the River Nid, and Olaf invited the local chiefs for a feast where he indicated he'd be willing to perform a heathen sacrifice. So they were quite impressed at this, and they all gathered, and Olaf said, "If I'm to return to performing a heathen sacrifice, then I'm going to make the greatest sacrifice. Well, I will not sacrifice slaves. I'm going to sacrifice men. I will sacrifice the greatest of men only." And then he named the most prominent leaders of the resistance to him. As the horrified heathen howled in protest, Olaf gave them a straight challenge, baptism or battle. He held 11 of the ringleaders as hostage until everyone else was baptized. At nearby Trondheim, the local chief Ironbeard demanded that the king offered sacrifices, as other kings before him had done. And Olaf said he would do so, and he walked into their temple and he smashed the idol of Thor. He came in and smashed the idol of Thor to pieces with his axe. He then killed Ironbeard, and he persuaded the rest of the village to ban the heathen ways and to be baptized as Christians. This was the most colorful missionary of all. And that is how Norway was converted. Further north, Olaf faced strong opposition of King Raud the Strong. Raud mobilized his army and a fierce sea battle was fought. Olaf's forces overwhelmed Raud's rebels. Raud escaped to take refuge in island hideout at Salten Ford. And the narrow channel to the ford was turbulent, and for a week no ship could enter. As Raud attempted to mobilize his witchcraft against the king, Olaf summoned his bishop to read the Gospels and to pray over the turbulent waters. By some miracle, his ships managed to negotiate the treacherous and turbulent rocky entrance to the ford, and he was able to confront Raud. So Raud was soon apprehended, and he was brought before the king, who ordered him to submit to Christ. And Olaf said, "I will not take your property from you, but instead I'll be your friend, if you make yourself worthy to be so." And when Raud rejected this offer with vile blasphemies, Olaf had his men force an adder down his throat. That's the most poisonous snake they've gotten. And he said, "You have foul blasphemies." And that was the last resistance to Olaf's crusade to eradicate paganism in Norway. Now he focused on winning Iceland to Christ, and then Greenland. And he in fact sent off the Ericssons, Eric the Red and Eric Ericsson, off to Leif Ericsson, off to Iceland with the mission of winning them to Christ, which they did. In fact, the whole Althing, that's the assembly of all the people of the landowners of Iceland, they decided to become Christian shortly after that, just in time for 1000 AD. So the millennium came to an end, and that was the end of the old order, the end of the old world, the end of the heathen gods. It was the beginning of a whole new millennium of Christianity in Scandinavia. Well, another, and this is where they gathered in Iceland, the Althing. Now each gathering or local assembly or provincial council was called a thing, and so the Althing was all the things coming together. And this is the Althing. As the people said afterwards, Althings work together for good. And at this point the people were so divided, and the missionaries explained the importance of being converted to Christ, and they carried the message of the King of Norway with them. Remember, Iceland was under Norway at that stage. And when they decided, "We are going to split into two laws, you can have the heathen law and we'll have the Christian law," just decided this will lead to war. And so, in fact, a pagan judge said, "Let us all choose rather to follow the Christian law, because obviously Christ is greater than Thor." And Iceland came to Christ as well. Well, that was not quite the end of it, because King Olaf, at the year 1000, was involved in a spectacular sea battle of Svold, and the pagan queen Sigrid the Haughty was furious that Olaf had spurned her advances, and so she mobilized two pagan kings to trap Olaf off the coast of Denmark. And you can see all the other ships, the longboats, have trapped them, and they made a tremendous slaughter around them. But at the end, there was just these few left, and they were completely surrounded, and Olaf died extremely courageously as he had lived, and he rejoiced that he had succeeded in his mission to convince the Vikings of Norway to abandon heathenism, to destroy their idols, and to commit to following the Christian faith. Now there's no doubt that as you relate these sort of stories, it's got to make the average squeamish Christian of today absolutely horrified, because this is not the way missionaries are meant to go about things, and it's not the way we understand evangelism to be done. But we live in a much more peaceful time in many ways, but not in all ways. And yet the fact is, God used these people, and what else would have made such a vicious, savage people as the Vikings submit to Christ? But this is how it worked. And then another prominent Norwegian king consolidated the Christian faith in Norway, and this was Olaf Haraldsson. So we've just spoken about Olaf. Let's get this right. This is Olaf Tryggvason. Olaf Tryggvason. But now there's another king, Olaf Haraldsson. And in 1007, when he was just 12 years old, Olaf Haraldsson was sent to sea as a sea king to raid Sweden. And later in Denmark, Olaf joined forces with Thorkel the Tall. And they launched raids on Jutland, and then Frisia and Holland and England, and they tormented poor King Ethelred the Unready, the same one who had been tormented so much under Olaf Tryggvason before. And in 1009, Olaf and Thorkel attacked London, East Anglia, plundered the cathedral, Canterbury Cathedral, martyred the Archbishop of Canterbury, raided Brittany, France, and Spain, and then Olaf had a dramatic vision, a terrifying vision of the risen Christ. And he was absolutely terror-struck. Now, these fearless Vikings had the fear of God struck into them when they saw a vision of Christ. Obviously, it wasn't gentle Jesus, meek and mild. And he immediately sought baptism. He abandoned his heathen ways. He committed to being a Christian. And in 1015, he would still have been very, very young if he was 12 years old in 1007. In 1015, this is a young man in his 20s. He arrives in Norway. He proclaims himself king and immediately proclaims a Christian faith throughout Norway. And he built numerous churches and he became known as the great lawgiver. He consolidated the work of discipling Norway, even as his predecessor had blazed the trail to open it up. His bishop was Bishop Grimkel, and together they propagated the Moster Law. That's not the Monster Law, it's the Moster Law. And the Moster Law was basically applying Christian laws to Norway. And most of Norway accepted this. But there was one area, Trøndelag, which continued with the heathen practices, and so the wrath of King Olaf came down on him. He could be a very kind, very pleasant person when he dealt with people normally. But the moment he dealt with people who were hostile to the gospel, then he could really fight. But he didn't wantonly kill. He only fought for a reason. He wasn't anything near as violent as his predecessor. And so, at Gulbrandsdal, depicted here, the local pagans confronted him with a huge wooden idol of Thor, and they wanted him to make a sacrifice before him. And he pointed out the sun that was rising in the distance, and he says, "Behold the herald of the Christian God." And as they turned to look at the sun rising, he had one of his warriors take his huge mace and smash to pieces this wooden idol of Thor. And its wood was rotten, and it just crumbled to pieces. And gold that had been given into the mouth of this rotten idol spilled out. And rats, big rats, came running out of this idol. And everyone saw that Thor's idol was rotten, and that the rats had obviously been consuming the fruits and other offerings that people had brought with food. And King Olaf then pointed to them and says, "You know, this gold would look so much better on your daughters and your wives. Why waste it in this rotten, decaying, rat-infested idol of Thor?" And this is one of these classic cases where he demonstrated Christ's superiority over Thor, and this convinced the locals to be baptized. And one contemporary report noted, "They who met as enemies parted as friends." Now, for 12 years, King Olaf ruled Norway, and he brought Iceland and the Faroe Islands to Christianity. And most unpopularly of all, he outlawed all Viking raids, which had always been considered an essential and acceptable part of life. When, how are you meant to get all these goods except by raiding? And he outlawed that. And that made him very unpopular. And for 12 years, King Olaf ruled Norway, but he was ousted by the Norwegians when they were unhappy about having their raids being outlawed. So in 1030, Olaf attempted to liberate his country from the Danes, and he came back, and there was this great battle at Stiklestad, where he is heavily outnumbered 3-1. And Olaf inspired his men with a battle cry called From, Christsmen, Crossmen, Konungsmen. On, Christsmen, Crossmen, Kingsmen. Olaf and his men fought boldly and bravely, as Vikings were expected to, but they were overwhelmed by superior numbers and died in the battle. Now, the Vikings grew to regret their betrayal of King Olaf, because the Danes taxed them far heavier than he had, and they oppressed them. And so within a year, Olaf was now being proclaimed as a saint by the very people who had betrayed him and killed him. And his remains were enshrined in the Church of St. Clement, and what he had failed to do in his life, he achieved in his death. He actually united and inspired the people of Norway to win their independence, their freedom, to be united as an independent Christian kingdom. And the cathedral in York was dedicated to St. Olaf, and Olaf was regarded by many medieval leaders as the example of the ideal ruler. At a church in Constantinople, they dedicated a church to his memory, and the sword he had wielded in the Battle of Stiklestad was hung over the high altar. And he's the last Western saint to be accepted as a saint by the Eastern Orthodox Church, King Olaf. How many times today do they choose a warrior who died in battle as a saint of the church? It shows you how the church has changed. The church militant has become the church doormat. And the church in York also was dedicated to the memory, the cathedral in York, dedicated to the memory of Saint Olaf. Well, the Vikings did surrender to Christ. And so it's a fact that by a combination of pioneer missionary work, royal favor, combat, the ferocious Vikings were convinced to abandon the heathenism, destroy their idols, abandon their aggression, cease their violent raids, submit to baptism, commit to following the Christian faith. And you can't simplify it. It's a tremendous, complex, spectacular, fascinating story. And the Vikings came to be convinced that the Christian God is more powerful than all other gods. They saw that God answers the prayers of Christians. They saw miracles. They saw that Christian kings and missionaries are able to destroy their idols and defy their heathen gods and their heathen taboos without any ill effects. So they saw that their pagan gods were powerless before the all-powerful Jesus Christ. And Christ was honored and worshipped as the mighty warrior who had triumphed over all the powers of death, hell, and the grave. He had ascended. He has risen triumphant over hell, death, and the grave. He's the ascended Christ. He is the King of Kings. He is the Lord of Lords. All other authorities are subject to him. And the scriptures say, yes, all kings will bow down to him, and all nations shall serve him. And this is this baptismal tank mentioned earlier, where that earlier king was baptized in Mainz. And you can see the inscriptions of that. Scandinavia is one to Christ. This is one of these magnificent churches that you get uniquely in Norway, all made of wood. Notice the dragons they have on the sides of them. The concept amongst the Vikings, there was the idea that church bells terrify demons and chase away demons. And demons hate the sounds of church bells. And in fact, this was one reason why you've got church bells very much throughout the whole north. And they would put dragons to frighten away the demons. Yes, that's an interesting concept, but there we go. And that's why you've got these dragons at the end. It's a uniquely Norwegian, Scandinavian thing. There you can see a Norwegian church, and here you can see a Swedish church. Again, different style completely. But there is no doubt that the Vikings came to Christ. The prominence of a cross in every Scandinavian flag serves as a dramatic testimony of the conversion of the Vikings. The Danish flag, the first of all. The huge, bold, white cross on red. The Norwegian flag, the blue cross on white and red. The Iceland flag, the red cross on white and blue. The Swedish flag of yellow cross on blue. And the Finnish flag of blue cross on white. And let's not forget also that the Vikings went and established themselves also heavily in England, not only the Danes before, but the Norwegians later, with the Battle of Hastings. And one of the prominent testimonies of that is the Tower of London, built by William the Conqueror. And there's a lot of these Norman castles which are just another proof of the fact. And in case you missed it, the Viking cross is even in the Union Jack of Great Britain. So you've got the cross of St. George, which was chosen by a Norman. Remember, that's what Richard the Lionheart was. And so the Vikings even put the cross, in this case, a triple cross. It's the crosses of both Patrick and of St. Andrew and of St. George overlapped into one in the true United Kingdom. So as you look at the impact of the Vikings, enormous impact. Russia, the whole of northern Europe, and even stretching across Iceland and Greenland. An incredible testimony to the power of the cross in conquering all. And you can see many of these very unique crosses, often with interesting testimonies and biblical stories and missionary testimonies. Christian history described it as a severe salvation. It had to be a severe salvation because these were severe, terrifying people. But soon they were taking missionaries to spread the faith even further. So, any comments, questions?
I was reading a book recently. I was speaking to a priest. He told me the Catholic Church, all the biggest Catholic churches in the world, they are built on pagan sites. Where there's a Catholic paganism, for example, let's say where the Aztecs, the human sacrifice, they built a great Catholic church there. And I was reading, you know, the Jesuit order, and I know this is before the Jesuits came. But I mean, what is it that in relation to the great Catholic churches where they built? Because I said they built.
But it's not just Catholic churches, any churches. If you go to Dar es Salaam, which means Dar es Salaam, the stronghold of Islam, which was the slave terminus where how many millions of Africans came as slaves to Dar es Salaam. When the British liberated the place and closed the slave market, they built a church in England right there in the slave market. You'll see up in Livingstonia, there's another church right on where the slave marketplace was in Livingstonia. If you go to Zanzibar, they built that too. You go to Nigeria, Adagra, and place where they built the first university in Africa. The church was built with the beams of ships of slave traders, which the British Navy had impounded, and they donated all the masts to be able to build a church in Nigeria. This is symbolic, and it's when Boniface, the great missionary to the Saxons, he is a Saxon missionary from England who went to the Saxons in Germany, to build his first chapel, he chopped down the sacred oak of Thor, which was worshipped as a monument to the war god Thor. He chops it down, builds his own chapel with it, and all the pagans are waiting for him to be struck dead by Thor, who controls the bolts of lightning after all, and nothing happens. And after a while they start coming to worship in church because they say, Boniface's god is obviously greater than Thor. So there's a good reason, a good symbolic reason to do that. But remember, the pagans can do the same to us. Geneva was a great place of reformation. Today the World Council of Churches has made Geneva the headquarters. You can see how they have tried to hijack England, Germany, America, wherever the gospel was strong. They're trying to come now, instead of people thinking the Protestant faith, they now think Hollywood, humanism, evolutionism. To think that places that produced the greatest of musicians and greatest of authors, now people are thinking of secular humanism and thick rock groups. We have beaten their gods before and triumphed over them, but as Christians have retreated, what did Jesus say? If the salt loses its saltiness, it's good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled under men. So when the church fails to be salt and light, let's not be surprised that we get trampled on, which is what they're doing. They're treating Christians like a doormat in parliaments, in cinemas, on TV, in universities. Why? Because the Christians have retreated. We might have built those universities to start with and those parliaments, but as the church says, oh, the gospel doesn't deal with these social and political issues, and Jesus is coming soon, so we don't need to get involved in this. Basically, we've got a self-fulfilling prophecy. We've allowed the pagans to triumph in places where before they had been completely routed.
I mean, yeah, I don't understand, because for example, in China, there's a big problem with Christianity. If you are found worshipping, because, I mean, if you're found with a cross, it's destroyed military in China. It's still part of China anyway.
Yes.
And it's the same with North Korea, because North Korea, they don't worship the son Kim Il-sung, they worship his father, Kim Il-sung Jong-il. He is the god of the Koreans. And the thing is that the argument is, they say, I was in one of the arguments, they say, what is the difference between, because they say Kim Il-sung is the god. And the thing is that they're not allowed to build a church in Korea. It's destroyed and in China.
Yeah, North Korea.
And in China as well.
So, well, China, there's some churches allowed, but they'll be the state churches, the three self-churches, and those churches are basically state-controlled. Every communist country except North Korea will have some state churches where they allow, but then they teach a very watered-down, subservient message. But the unregistered churches are heavily persecuted. North Korea, I don't think there are any churches. Father, on this last trip, came back with, it was given to me one day, this is one of a replica of one of the pages from the Gutenberg Bible. This is in Latin, of course, but one of the first printed works ever. So it's a replica we got in Oxford. So Uncle N got that framed. We'll add that to our Reformation wall outside later. Any other questions, comments on Scandinavians? Vikings?
Peter, I also read that a part of these fierce raids of the Vikings, especially on monasteries and religious settlements, was sort of in retaliation or in sort of to try and prevent the evangelization of their own countries. Mm. Now, whether even historians have got varying ideas about these things.
It's possible to a degree, but the power behind these pagan gods that they were worshipping, Odin, Thor, was plainly the devil. So you can just see the supernatural demonic hatred for the church. Just like today, you've got the Muslims showing such hatred towards Christianity and burning churches and killing Christians, or communism attacking church. Surely it's the power behind it. The ideology is hostile, but there's also something even beneath it. There's a supernatural hatred. As Jesus said, if they hated me, they'll hate you too. Servant is not greater than his master. So the church will suffer. But the extraordinary thing is, the Saxons, who suffered the worst at the hands of the Vikings, brought the Vikings to Christ. Mm. This is just a remarkable thing. But the gospel they used to bring them was a powerful gospel. The Vikings were not one with a gentle Jesus, meek and mild, Jesus loves me, this I know type of gospel. They were one with a Christ is the greatest, Christ is triumphant, he is all powerful. He is far more mighty than your pathetic little Thor and Aiden. And so that the entire outlook of the message, they've preached a tough gospel. Nothing other than a tough gospel about an all-powerful God could have won warriors as fierce and savage as the Vikings.
Yeah, God is the God of hosts, you know, the Lord of hosts. Mm. I mean, even with Constantine, you know, he saw this sign in the sky, and he said, which said, by this sign you shall conquer. Okay. You know, it's the Lord of hosts, but we never speak of the Lord of hosts anymore.
we're producing doormat Christianity that's apologetic, which is not particularly wise. Now, of course, even someone who's as militarily orientated as myself is shocked by the intensity and ferocity with someone like King Olaf in how he converted them. And yet the point is, we weren't there. And what they were facing, and remember at that time civilization was the warm, sunny Mediterranean area. That's civilization. The cold, frigid, dark, icy north, that was the absolute backwards of darkness. That was paganism, heathenism. That was the end of the earth. And, you know, today we think of some of the most advanced places in the world as being Nordic areas. But remember, they've since invented electricity, and there's been a lot of advances in this internal heating, and that makes a big difference. Just imagine how savage those areas must have been, how tough you must have been to live in those icy, inhospitable conditions. And you're going in open boats on icy waters, open longboats. Phenomenal. I mean, these people really were tough. And
but you know, they say that there was a different climate in those days, that around 1,000 or, you know, around about there, plus minus a few, 100 years or so, that there was a particularly mild climate in the north. That was why Greenland could be settled.
Mm.
You know? There was in Thule, you know, which is now a tiny little place in Greenland. You can still see it on the map. The king was actually living there. You know, so, I mean, nowadays I'm sure no ruler of this present world would go and settle in Thule. And they also say that it was much wetter, so that actually the rivers which went up from the Black Sea to the Baltic Sea were married people, and that is how the Rus came down, even as far as the Crimea. And that until quite recently in the Crimea, they still had tall, blonde, blue-eyed girls who were descendants of
the Vikings.
Early Vikings.
Mm. Yes, the entire Russian royal family from that side was Viking, the original ones we're talking about. Ivan the Terrible and Peter the Great and all of those. The original ones were, the Romanovs came from the Swedish Vikings, the Rus. Now, later from Catherine the Great, she was German. And so from Catherine the Great, they became far more Germanic, but originally they were all the Vikings.